All right, everybody. Hello. Welcome. This is an exciting day for me because this is my first deep dive podcast, which is a special show where we go into some aspect of fish that needs further exploration. And because I'm no expert in these various areas, I will tend to have a co-host with me for the deep dives.
Interpretation. Reflection. Misdirection. That's my job. It really is my job. I write words for fish. I'm Tom Marshall, and this is Under the Scales.
Today, I'm happy to have two co-hosts. I have RJ and Jonathan. These two guys have their own fish podcast, and just because of possibly the fact that they're extremely friendly, they decided rather than compete with me, the brand new podcast guy in the fish realm, they decided to help me, which is completely awesome and just what you might expect after years of hanging out with fish people. So I shouldn't be surprised, and yet they're very generous. And I'd like to say welcome, RJ, and welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
So tell the audience a tiny bit, if you wouldn't mind, about your podcast.
Sure. Yeah. This is RJ. We started the Helping Friendly podcast about 3 years ago. And the idea was really to create a forum where fans could just come and talk a little bit about their favorite band and really get into detail about their favorite shows, their favorite jams, their favorite moments. We talk a lot on the podcast about the quote unquote it moment, the moment that you realize you love the band. And that's usually one of the best moments, but we really try to get into it. And then we share a ton of music along the way for people who don't listen to fish all the time.
So Jonathan is here also in the capacity of helping me and RJ to explain the topic of tonight's deep dive, because he's actually a more of a technical expert, and RJ's an overall expert as well in the field of taping. And tonight's episode is about tapers. So tapers hold a special place in the fish history, and they hold a special place in the Grateful Dead's history. And lots of bands actually allow fans to tape and then distribute for free their music. And fish is no exception. You might notice behind the soundboard during shows this area where people guard very carefully because there's some expensive equipment there, these mic stands that tower above the audience. And those mic stands hold expensive microphones that sometimes can get better recordings than the soundboard can. And so while there's some people that really love the soundboards the next day that you can get from livefish.com, there's other purists that still love and listen to tapes made by these tapers. And both RJ and Jonathan have taped fish shows and possibly other bands. Apparently I got that wrong. I'm already seeing a head shaking. But anyway, RJ, tell me a tiny bit about taping, like from a beginner's standpoint. What are tapers and why are they still taping and what's going on with them?
Cool. Yeah, thanks, Tom. And thanks for the introduction and the compliments. We're excited to be collaborating, obviously. I haven't ever taped a fish show. That was why I was shaking my head. But I would consider myself a great consumer of taped fish shows. I think one of the biggest, so you'll hear the biggest kind of controversy will be the soundboard, as you mentioned, versus audience recordings. And some people just love audience recordings. There are people who swear by soundboards and people who swear by audience recordings, but we'll get into that a little bit later. I think Jonathan can talk a little bit more about when it actually started. I think it started in the 60s and 70s with the Dead. And really, one thing I read that I thought was interesting is the hiatus that the Dead went on, 74 to 76, provided this opportunity for people who wanted to catch up, you know, and people really started this whole idea of collecting tapes and going back to what had been happening before.
When you say people catching up, you're talking about fans that want to jump on board.
Yeah, exactly.
What is this Grateful Dead thing that I hear about?
Yeah.
And at that time, were they getting cassettes in the mail? So someone in California would get a cassette out to his friend in New Jersey?
They were trading reels back then.
reels.
Yeah. I mean, guys were taking reel-to-reel decks and recording concerts, which is obscene considering we're doing four channels on a thing that's not much bigger than a pack of cigarettes now. But yeah, they were recording and the shows with reels and trading them on reels. And
so in terms of widespread consumer availability, you might say, it sounds like that would be available to dudes that have reel-to-reel decks at the time and not really until cassettes came out.
Cassettes really blew it up, for
yeah,
sure.
That must have
more portable, more convenient, easier to ship.
So that's when it went nuts.
I had to be. And of course, before my time, but yeah, it started with people taping concerts kind of on the sly, Grateful Dead concerts. And over time, it got to be, you know, they overlooked, that is to say, you know, they let it happen and just let it happen. And finally, they had to formalize the thing because there were too many mic stands in between Dan Healy, the sound guy, and the band. He needed them out of his sight lines. So they established a taper section in the early 80s, right about the time when Fish was starting.
Do you think there was ever a moment that the band was like, get rid of them? This isn't helping us commercially?
I'm sure there was conversations about that, but Jerry's spoken philosophy was, once I play the notes, I'm done with them. They can have them. Mm-hmm. And I'm paraphrasing the quote.
Right, right. But and then it turns out to be a stroke of genius in a way, because we were just talking, you know, I was given the hypothetical about a guy in California telling his friends in New Jersey about the Grateful Dead.
Right.
The same thing, and then I lived through this, was totally happening with Fish.
Absolutely.
On rec.music.fish, I kept seeing, and this is a while ago, folks, I kept seeing people, you know, asking for B&P, which meant that they had a pretty good copy of a show, mm-hmm. and they were willing for blanks and postage to give it to you. So you had to send them a blank cassette tape or two and postage. And presumably what you get back is the music on the tapes and possibly a set list, or do they assume you know that?
You know, usually you'd send it out and they would just jot it down on a piece of paper and you could fill in your J card, you know, your custom psychedelic print J card yourself after the fact. But
there's a whole etiquette about what you do with J cards and how you send.
What's a J card?
So J card is the little piece of cardboard that goes around a cassette tape.
Oh, shaped like a J.
Yeah, exactly. Got it. So when I started trading tapes and I amassed, I don't know, 600 of them, we really.
Did you say 600?
600, yeah.
And are they Fish tapes or Dead tapes?
No, these are 600 Fish tapes.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
And if you were to take an average of when those occurred, would that plop me right into 97 or would it put me in 98, 99?
It would be in probably 96, 97 because I started collecting them in 93, 94. So I was catching up while I was also staying current. And the whole experience is amazing because you would send out, you know, I'd go to Best Buy or there was no Best Buy, whatever it was at that time, you'd buy a block of cassette tapes.
Maxell, XL2.
Circuit City.
Yeah, exactly. Maxell, XL2s, and you send them out to people in padded envelopes. And there's a whole etiquette. You don't want other people filling out your J card, you know, because that's like your own signature, right? So they would, like Jonathan said, you write it on a piece of paper and put it in the envelope. And then I started taping things for people, and that's sort of how the whole culture caught on, right? You amass some sort of cool basis for tapes, and then you start sharing them with others.
Did it I imagine that rapidly a sort of leader, like the best set of mics, would appear on the scene, and everyone would want that tape. Is that sort of a thing, or was everyone kind of sourcing different versions, or did somehow a consensus arise as to which was the best one? How did that work?
It was organic and a lot not by choice. So some tapers were quicker to get stuff out, you know, and some tapers didn't circulate their stuff far and wide. And when, you know, by the 90s, when DAT taping was becoming in vogue, then it was the tapers would trade with other DAT traders, wouldn't necessarily make analog cassettes for us, you know, lowly analog people.
And a DAT and is so a small digital
audio tape.
Digital audio tape. You need a deck. I've got a couple of them by my Lazy
Jonathan
Boy.
Jonathan has them. I don't have one.
You know, the DAT taper would, or collector would, one of them would eventually deign to make, analog tapes for somebody, and then those would circulate. So it took time, and it really took months, sometimes years, for shows to appear on the trading scene, and sometimes it just took a week.
But for the most part, you're getting analog copies, which means, like you said, you're getting a generation removed. So eventually, as these disseminate across the country, they're losing a level of quality.
Right.
Exactly.
But when digital happened, the degradation stopped.
Yeah. And well, I think it depends who you ask, because people would say that the digital version itself was a degradation of the, you know, because MP3s, they have a certain amount of compression and it's not lossless as like a FLAC or something else could be, right?
Right. And when digital went mainstream and got out of the tape world and we started trading digitally online, most of us were really focusing on lossless audio. And so we didn't get, you know, generations introduced, because we'd been dealing for years with, wow, it's only a second gen or a third gen analog, but now I can get exactly what the taper got.
Okay, so let me ask you guys now from the perspective of the sound guy. And back in the day, it used to be Paul, of course. What's his relationship with tapers? And what's the protocol? Like, would he ever give a feed from the soundboard to someone with a recorder and let them just give it out for free? Or were those closely guarded, or did that come later, et cetera? What do you guys know about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We were just talking about this today.
Yeah, unfortunately, when I started seeing them, I don't think that was really happening anymore.
So anymore implies that Paul used to give feeds to people?
It seems as if there were. And I think some of the tapers you're going to talk to might know more about that.
Would there be a proviso that only if it's analog or something like that? Or what happened? Like,
I don't think there was that. It might have been just as simple as, you know, we're going to record a live album here in 1994, and so we need to keep this for ourselves.
It became a little bit more proprietary. I mean, there were definitely, if you go back and find any pre-93 show, you can find a soundboard.
Okay,
you
know, a lot of soundboards out there.
People would go and they would plug in, or they would be leaked or whatever, and you'd get a soundboard. But starting around 93, 94, we were trying to pin that down exactly. They stopped appearing, and I think that's when they decided. I mean, I assume it's when lawyers got involved and were like, what are you guys doing?
So it became sort of a policy no longer to allow the music directly from the board to come out.
Right.
And which then, is, in some people's perspective, purer than what you can get on a mic. And yet, you'll get people that argue.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the soundboard is theoretically what is going to the speakers flying above the stage.
Oh, right.
But the the taper is attempting to capture the best possible picture of the sound in the room.
Oh, right. Mm-hmm. So the audience experience.
The audience, yeah. Without too much overload of the audience. But yeah, you're trying to get what it sounds like at that point in time and try to make it, you know, the best mix of as if you're in the room.
Right. Yeah. So can you guys tell me anything about, I remember, and I've talked to people about this, and I don't really remember the motivation behind it, but people hiding mics in their hats and trying to sneak in front of the board.
Yeah.
So like FOB is like, it was frowned upon by the Fish, Fish Inc.
Yeah, Fish Inc, yeah.
But people did it nonetheless. Was the sound better up there, or what happened?
Yeah. Yeah.
It was more than frowned upon. People got tossed for doing it, and they got to know who would do it, and they would seek them out. And but so I spoke about capturing the sound in the room. Well, if you go front of board, you're getting that much more of the audience is behind you. You're getting the sweet spot. You're starting to hear the sound on the stage, you know, and you've played on stage, so you know that you're hearing the amplifier on the stage, you're hearing the live drum as opposed to, or in addition to, what's mixed through the PA. And that's a very different sound.
That's incredible.
And arguably a lot better. So there's a reason people really enjoy being in the pits, not just the sight lines.
So can you guys name like a famous front of board tape?
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah, one comes to mind immediately. I mean, he did the Europe tour in 98, the July 98 tour he did those shows with a mic in his hat. That's him standing there. And apparently, I mean, think about how little you can move to have a microphone in your hat during a Fish show. It's insane. Well, I could never do it.
If you have one microphone, maybe you could get away with it. But having a stereo pair oriented in your hat, if you turn your head, the tape's going to hear like phasing shifts.
Oh, geez.
If you move around, there's going to be possibly jostling.
So human for not moving your head during that show.
So
at
many,
all.
So many props to him.
It can be easy to spot those a front of board in hat kind of taper too, though.
Because
sometimes,
they're not moving.
They stand still. They don't clap. They do the little like.
But that could
clap.
Be the guy that had the wrong combination of pre-party.
Yeah, it's a toss up.
Right. Well, I also think it's. I mean, so that example, Europe. Like, there might not have been other tapes of that, right?
No.
Not of the whole tour. And he that's a huge contribution to the community that we would otherwise not have had.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because the tapers who still tape now, even when digital, music is so instantaneous, it's so high quality, it's kind of everything that you need. But, they are still capturing a different perspective. And I really love hearing their perspective because it's... They feel like it's a responsibility, not like they're delivering us music, but they're giving us an experience that we wouldn't otherwise get.
It's
a service. I love that. That's awesome. That's amazing. Do you have anything else on your list there? I see you writing down furiously. Anything we need to talk about? Because next, I think we should have our first guest, possibly.
Yeah, I guess just to set up the first guest, I think it's interesting for people to keep in mind. I guess I've always had this like idea of the persona of the taper who is protective of their space and protective of their equipment, and rightly so. But
you have to. I mean, you've got, Tom mentioned earlier, you've got potentially thousands of dollars worth of gear, and some guy who's having a really wonderful time wants to get from here to there, and you're in the way, and that thing looks really good to hang on to, and it's going to ruin your tape or most of your equipment. Right. So there is a kind of rightfully earned but possibly misunderstood reputation of tapers as being guarded about their space and their gear, and they should be guarded about their space and their gear, but on the whole they're good people, and as I said, they're doing a service for the community.
It sounds like they're in a way it's pretty selfless, because they don't get to party with their friends as much. They've got to sit there.
They do all right.
All right. That's good.
I was kind of under the same assumptions.
Well, at least I was going to set up that maybe next time you're next to the taping section, you can just say thank you to those guys.
Definitely.
Hello, listeners. This is Tom with a brief mid-podcast message to remind you that I'm always looking for fish-related stories and topics, and I'm always looking for new subjects and new people to interview. If you feel like you might be able to contribute to this podcast, go to underthescales.com and click the Tell Your Story button. I read every legitimate submission, so don't hesitate. Follow our Twitter to stay up to date at Under the Scales. Now back to the show.
All right, cool. So, while you listeners don't realize it, no time has passed in your world. We've actually made a personnel swap. We've lost Jonathan, and we've gained Lenny Stubbe. Am I saying that name right, Lenny?
Wow, I hope somebody helped you with that. That's impressive, if not.
I got to admit, I got a little help. So RJ and John were able to kind of catch me up on tapers and the community and the history and how it related to the Grateful Dead. And we even got fairly technical. But one thing RJ, and RJ knows this because he knows you from the past. This is really your and my first conversation ever. So I want to say hello, but more than that, I want to tell you kind of why we're happy to have you on today. It's because anytime I talk to anyone about tapers, your name came up. And so we really want to know why.
When Fish came back in 2009, I think if you guys kind of probably have noticed, like a lot of people, obviously not only were excited, but just kind of said, like get back into it. It was an exciting time. Fish was back.
Are you implying that like during the big break, I guess the 2004 to 2009 break when Fish went from Fish 2.0 to 3.0, a lot of people kind of, obviously there was no live band to tape. Were you saying like you completely sort of just stopped taping at all, or did you go to other bands?
Oh, no, entirely. I mean, it, you know, but I had even previous to that. But I think there are tapers certainly that tape everything. And there's a lot of them out there. They tape bar bands. They tape everything all the way up to stealth stadium recordings of Bruce Springsteen or whoever else.
Oh, wow.
You know, but then there's people that are just like, I just want to tape Fish and really nothing else. And those people, you know, so, and some went away the first, you know, the first hiatus. And then certainly we all went away when the band went away. And then I think some just dusted it off and said, let's get back into this. And, you know, the band had a whole new vibe and a new feel and even a new sound, a new front house engineer and Gary Brown. And there was a different, a whole different feel going on. So if you look at all the tapes from Hampton in 09, the most you'll ever see almost at any Fish show, everybody came out for that, you know, return. So that's kind of a little microcosm of, you saw it happening and everyone kind of stuck around.
Ah, that's really cool. Hey, that's a good time to ask. With the earlier sound engineer, the front of house guy being Paul, and, you know, establishing a relationship with the tapers, was there kind of ever a moment where you guys had to introduce yourselves to Gary, or was it just sort of like you ignored each other in a friendly way, or how did that work?
Yeah, I think a lot of tape, you know, you keep your distance. And I think Gary being brand new, tapers absolutely, you know, whispered at him and tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, you know, great job. And, you know, thanks for what you're doing. And it sounded great. And so I think everyone had a moment there of, you know, getting acclimated to him and, you know, the sound of the room. And it really, it has changed, actually. It started changing around 2013. Gary did some different things and brought in an analog mixer. And
well, I just wanted to, I feel like fans would wonder, Lenny, a little bit more detail about the changes that were made in 2013. I'm just curious, is there a sort of summary of how you would describe it?
Well, it's hard, you know, we're not on the inside, so we really don't know. It's a lot of speculation. So it definitely changed. I mean, he brought in a whole new console, went to an analog console, and Gary humored me with some discussion about it. And I'm not in any way an expert, or I don't have any knowledge, to be very honest, on that end of it. All I know is what I hear coming out of the PA and, you know, where to point the mics and that kind of thing. And, you know, it just, to me, it really changed. It felt like it changed a lot. If you listen to some tapes prior to that, so SPAC 12 to SPAC 13 is my best AB comparison because I taped same situation 1 year after the other. It just, Mike went from having that real gooey, you know, digital modulus sound to like almost like a heavy metal, harsher bass sound, you know, just had a different feel. And you can even hear it, you can hear it, you know, in just any of those signature mic notes that he drops. One I talked about was like the Runaway Jim, you know, it's there in 2012. Cause I think they played Runaway Jim that year and there. Mm. And then like, it's just gone the next year. Like you don't even hear it. Mm.
Interesting.
That's cool. And I feel like maybe we should let you tell us. So why did your name come up, Lenny, every time? Like, are you like the king of tapers?
No,
or?
Not at all. By no means. And I would be remiss if I didn't, you know, pay tribute to the guys that really paved the way. There's people like Dave Flashner, you know, Elliot Byron, you know, many, Linda Webster from the 90s. But, you know, no, I'm not. The reason my name is out there is because, well, I was a collector. I was a faithful collector, a hardcore collector, just from cassettes to DAT tapes.
What years? When was your heyday?
So, 95, when Jerry died, I got into the music around 93. And, you know, started with the Grateful Dead, of course. And then one of my good buddies who was with me at that Auburn Hill show said, if you like the Grateful Dead, you'll love Fish. And I don't know how he drew that comparison because it didn't always hold true in all the Deadheads I argued with. But
is it so, the lyrics?
not at all. I think it's just more complicated music really, that they can't get over.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's not the lyrics at all. I've defended you right to the death, man.
Oh, gosh. Well.
But yeah, so naturally, you know, starting listening to Grateful, being, you know, totally engrossed in Grateful Dead culture and music and getting into Fish. So when Jerry passed away, I got to see him, you know, a dozen or so times, and then I thought to myself, geez, I wish I recorded him. I didn't record him. So I went out September of 95 and bought my first DAT deck, and just went out and started patching like a madman and met great people like, you know, Craig Hilwig and Stan Lobitz and Eric Vanderkar, and became good friends with all these guys. And I knew so many people with great microphones and really high end stuff. So I just brought my digital recorder and they patched me in, but I always hung out with them in the taper section. And so I collected and then I distributed. And that's one of the big disconnects with some tapers. Not all tapers are very good at sharing or distributing. And I think, to answer your question, long story short, is that I distributed probably as good as anybody as far as anything that I had. And got right out there. And I seeded a lot of the Project 1996 when I was really collected everything. So I was able to, you know, single-handedly supply that almost a good chunk of that year to the whole Phish community digitally back in 2002.
What you're talking about right now just brought a little question to my mind. And I'm wondering, this might be a little bit more philosophical or music biz-like, but do you think that fact that the Grateful Dead and Phish allows taping may have painted them as a particular type of band? I mean, it's a blessing as far as spreading the word, but could it be a curse in terms of the music business? They get categorized as that kind of band, you know, forever branding them as non-commercial?
Sure. I mean, no, I don't think so, because really when you display the music in such a way, you're almost encouraging it.
Well, I'm talking more almost like, no, I understand from your perspective, it's like there's nothing bad about taping, but I'm talking about like there's an executive, you know, up in some office and saying like, you know what, they're never going to get a hit, or more nefariously, we're never going to let them have a hit. Or maybe again, that's no, just because no. I can't write a hit.
or you're trying not to, right? But I think Jerry is quoted as saying that they were trying to sell out and have a number one hit, and it just, they couldn't do it or something like that. But we always thought you guys would throw something in there to keep it off the, you know, keep it off the charts.
Tom, one thing, I mean, it's worth mentioning, I think, is that over the past, I don't know, 10 years, I guess, as digital music has become more of the prominent way we consume it, I think there is an argument now that, you know, promoters and record producers and all those people are potentially looking for people who can draw a crowd, you know? And this is like, so I don't know. I feel like the last 5 or 10 years have been more of like Phish and the Dead finally getting their due, that like their live credit. Music is where it's at. They had to credit their due, because I don't know. I just feel like it's turned that way.
Well, I agree. It's like, it's kind of the golden age in a way of jam bands. I mean, this recent Lock-In Fest, and I wasn't there. None of us managed, even though we're East Coast people, none of us managed to get there, which is embarrassing. But from what I absorbed from Couch Tour and from reading and stuff, and not just Phish, just all the bands, everyone had a phenomenal time. And it's kind of like almost a heyday coming back of jam bands.
You know, I was talking to Mike Ganser from Aqueous, who is a Buffalo. I'm from Buffalo, New York, so shameless plug. You know, Aqueous is out there playing the festival circuit all summer, and they're really, really a nice young band. And I was talking to their lead guitar player about this topic, and they're young kids. I mean, they're in their early 20s, and they weren't around when Jerry was around, really, or anything like that. And they allow taping, but there's really nothing going on as far as encouraging of it. And Humphreys McGee, on the other hand, I'm not going to say tapers are in any way, you know, deserving of the credit of their success, but there is not a more taper friendly band in the jam band scene than Humphreys McGee. And there hasn't been for a decade. You know, they guest list tapers, they accommodate tapers, they create space for tapers. They ask tapers to come out. They always have, even when they were smaller, they always had done that. And I mentioned that to Mike Ganser from Aqueous. I said, you know, if you guys just kind of, you know, just extend your arms out a little bit, just a little. And when you're playing in Denver, you know, for the first time, like you did last year, and maybe there'll be a local taper, they'll say, you know, I'm going to go out and see those guys. They want us to come out. I'm going to record them. And there's almost a rite of passage that if your recording hits the E-Tree website, a taper is almost, I don't want to sound too, you know, flighty here, but maybe it's put their stamp of approval on your music, and they've put it out there. So now maybe people will say, I got to check that band out. You know,
I love that. That's really, really great, especially the passing the torch reference, because now these are the younger bands coming through. And it's cool to hear that they, you know, the taping community can continue to thrive with like Humphreys. What about bands, and this one killed it at Lock-In, apparently, like My Morning Jacket?
Yeah, they've always allowed recording for sure. But obviously they've definitely had more commercial success. So I think that's a great example. I'm glad you brought them up because I think that's an example of a band that's, you know, having some commercial success, but also embracing the fanatical fan base that they have through the distribution of their music, you know, at an amateur level, so to speak, and encouraging it within the fan base. I think it can't hurt, and it hasn't hurt them, I'm sure.
All right. Well, then while I'm on this topic and asking questions, because as you can tell, I'm somewhat ignorant about this. Does Dave Matthews or Pearl Jam allow recording?
Yeah, actually, interesting question. Dave Matthews does. They allow you to record from your seat. They allow you to record from the pit and the amphitheater shows down front, kind of be disruptive a little bit, you know, with a big tall stand. And
really?
Yeah, Dave Matthews has always been welcoming of tapers. You have to shoot your mic stands up really high. There's a lot of screaming young kids at that those shows though, so they're challenging shows to tape. And Pearl Jam actually has always been okay with tapers. I think the problem that we've always had with Pearl Jam is bringing in mic stands. I don't think they could go to bat, and it's really up to the band to really go to bat with you know, whatever deals they have with the venues and what they allow to happen inside the venue during their show. So I don't think Pearl Jam goes to bat on bringing in any sort of mic stands, but they won't stop you from finding a way to get your mics exposed and recording the music.
Right. Now, in terms of going to bat for tapers, I would think that Phish, just because of tradition, should be pretty friendly to tapers. Now, does that mean that there's a certain group of people that are allowed to get taping tickets? And how is that policed?
Well, this is the really the sore subject right here.
Really?
Yeah, this is...
I found the sore subject.
Really, not a good one. This is like, you don't want to say anything bad about your mom and dad, you know, kind of, right? You don't
right?
want to, like, I mean, I'll try to be political about this, but right, they're operating off of a taping policy that was really, really good when Shelley was running the tickets in 1995, you know, the Phish tickets by mail, when we started off with those. It worked really well back then, but guess what? Not today. With all the digital age and the ability to, you know, scalpers and all the abilities that they have to run their programs and steal all the tickets and whatever they do this. I don't know how they do it. I'm not really privy to it. But so Phish has really not done anything for us, to be very honest. They've kept this stale policy in place, and tapers can't get tickets, really, to be
honest. Oh, okay. So wait. So are you implying that there's no one that's like, there's no such thing as a credential that you guys earn somehow, I don't know how, prove that you're a taper, and there's no tickets specifically set aside for you?
So Phish does set aside the tickets. They offer them on the website, on the Phish ticket online system. However, anybody can order it. Anybody can select a taper ticket. Many of these, you know, especially the newer fans, because I'm saying newer fans because I see them in the taper section, younger kids with taper tickets that have no, don't even know what a taper is, but all they know is they got inside the pavilion. They're not on the lawn at SPAC or Blossom. So yeah, it's a slippery slope, and there's not necessarily a perfect answer for it, but Phish has kind of given tapers the thumbs up by offering the taper tickets, but really not doing anything to get them in the taper's hands.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I hope the right people might hear this and do something about it. You know,
there's bands like Widespread Panic, similar to Dave Matthews. It's a tape from your seat kind of location. And in the band's defense and in Red Light's defense, over the last, you know, 7 years that we've been doing this and then the new era, tapers haven't been necessarily refused entry. As far as any of us know, we've never had any examples of that. It does get dicey on the inside because you just don't have, I mean, there was the time was there when we had a roped off section and some protection from, you know, the person that would stumble in with a drink. And that happened a lot over the years. And, you know, Grateful Dead shows in the past, those people would end up like under the blanket, you know, you don't want to stumble in one of those paper sections, but, not at Phish shows, but, so they haven't necessarily refused entry or created that, but when you get inside and you've got all this equipment and, you know, and you have nowhere to really set up that's feasible where you can't get in anybody's way. And it's dicey. And so many tapers just say, heck with it, you know, let the couple, two or three guys that are out there that are hardcore and won't give up and will just fight and deal with it. Let them do it.
Darn. Well, it sounds like you should be able to apply for some kind of taper status, and let's hope that happens. And now, Lenny, I believe we should change channels again.
So, you know, I know you're asking, you know, my past and where I come up through the music and such. So again, September 95, I buy this DAT deck and I get out and I start recording shows and I get some Radio Shack mics for like that one-off local show that I want to record. So Auburn Hills, you know, happens, and I'm going, I got my ticket, but I didn't have a taper ticket. So I was able to stuff my deck down in the pants, get it through security. I'm in the venue and we're in at doors, and I'm with a good buddy of mine who turned me, one of my buddies that helped turn me on to Fish, several years before that. And, we're inside, we get into the palace, and I was there for the dead that summer. So it was cool to be back, and we're looking at the fans kind of filing in. So we're trying to devise a plan to get down to the floor because I don't know any real tapers, because I was a collector, not a taper. So we're trying to devise a plan to get down to the floor so we can get to the taper section and record. And we look to our right, and there's a gentleman standing there with a laminate on. and we strike up a conversation. And that gentleman says his name is Tom Marshall.
Who did this guy actually turn out to be?
Well, this is interesting. We said, really? so you don't say. And of course, we're starstruck. And my buddy is a real, you know, aficionado, and he knows all the facts and figures. And he starts quizzing you, Tom. And
oh no,
he asked you something about the sloth. And I wish I could. He would be able to. I know. Said maybe something about Farley Warp Tour. I don't know what it was. Was that what?
By the way, the correct answer for me, and this was why it was sort of a secret, like a super question, was because I didn't write the sloth. So that's what he wanted me to say.
Is that what it was? I thought you credited as partial lyrics or something.
So in McGrupp, I guess I came up with. I know the sloth was in that story, the Farley Warp, right?
Yes, that's the connection.
Yeah, that's it.
That's part of the connection. And you, however you answered it, and if I found him, he'd be able to say this way better than me.
Right.
But, you know, you answered it perfectly. But in no way of thinking that talking to you could benefit me in any way, where you just explained, like, yeah, just trying to figure out how to get down and get hooked up with the taper. You know, we don't have taper tickets. And you said, I'll get you down there. And I'll take you down myself. And I know a taper or two. I could probably help you find a patch if you need one. And you escorted the two of us down to the floor, got us into the taper section, and we were on our own for the rest of the night. So if I thanked you then, I want to thank you now.
You're welcome. It sounds uncharacteristically friendly of me, but you know, I try to be friendly. I should say, in the old days, the all access pass sort of actually meant all access. Whereas the band, there's like a trick now. There's like four different levels of all access, and I think I get the lowest one now.
You probably helped out too many tapers. No, but there were guys like you and Big Phil and just people that, you know, helped us out a lot.
When I asked you about stories, I was thinking more of the one that you sort of alluded to in general, if any specific lumbering drunk gorillas came through and took out an entire section. Yeah.
Thankfully, not to me specifically, but I know those stories have happened and they're rough. And that was RJ's first show too, Auburn Hills 95, right?
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, it's a good stroke of luck that we're all here talking together.
Oh, that's cool. Hey, RJ, so what am I leaving out? Because we have the king of the tapers here.
I mean, I think, Lenny, one thing would be interesting to hear is just sort of how you would approach a, you know, show indoors versus outdoors. What do you prefer, festival? Like, what's the kind of ideal situation for you? And
so I think most tapers would go with this, and not only just my personal preference, but where we have most success is the open field, open air shows. So some of the best recordings I've made are the Watkins Glen shows in recent years. So the 11 Super Bowl and the Magna this past year. So just wide open air, big PA system, and getting the ability in that setting to kind of get close to the stage, carve out a little bit of space, and not be too disruptive, and kind of get those mics pointed up the right way and kind of capturing that sound. And that is really what we're after. That's what we can do, and we can offer that result in that setting that to me, to my ears, I prefer so much more than what I hear on a soundboard recording. It's just a big sound and you don't have the reverberations, the walls, the, you know.
That's funny. You might have stumbled on it for me and a lot of my friends, probably a lot of us. There's something magic about the outdoor show, and there's something amazing, especially like still daylight, it's warm, you're with all your friends, the band comes out and Punch You in the Eye comes on, and it's phenomenal. There's something incredible about being outdoors and hearing a good sound system. You're right. So you can duplicate that really well. So can you give us an example of a really good recording from outdoors that we should pursue?
So I would absolutely, the Magna Ball from last summer, the What's the Use set, just unbelievable how, I think everybody was talking about how incredibly quiet and well-behaved that, and really not even well-behaved, but how dialed in that audience was during that portion of the set. You know, the Sense and Subtle Sounds and how it just dropped, and you could really just, it was pure silence, it was all sound, and there we were just under the stars just soaking it up. It was just, couldn't have been more perfect, and it completely transfers to the tapes. Like it's proof positive that's, you know, what we're after. This is the result that we were completely after, and we went in and we got it.
Brings me to a point. These recordings are supposed to be free and available. So I'm a beginner. Could you send me to a website and how to find it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So eTree. So the website is BT for bittorrent.eTree.org. And so BitTorrent is the way to collect and pull down audience recordings.
Okay.
That is the site where tapers go universally to share Phish music, specifically. All the Phish recordings are there, and of course, many other bands.
Okay. So RJ, help me out with a couple of last questions for Lenny. We've kept you for a long time and we really appreciate it.
No, I have one question, Lenny, that is inspired by listening to a download of the Trey Band Peach Festival set from August. And the very beginning of the show, there's someone who's a woman, crystal clear, on the audience recording, who's saying, right when the recording starts, I'm going to be quiet when the band starts. I promise I'm not going to fuck up the taper experience. And it's just like, I've never taped, and I've probably been working on tapers than anything, but like I cringed, and I can imagine that that's a warning sign. I'm just curious, and I personally feel like the taper is like the comic book guy from The Simpsons who's like, yep, you know, protecting his rig. And is it complimentary most of the time, or is it adversarial a lot?
It's a great question, and I've had a lot of personal experience in this, and you can hear it in certain recordings myself. And, you know, we're not supposed to disrupt anybody's enjoyment of the show, and far be it that we would ever do that. And we don't want to do that, but I mean, let's be honest, we're dropping thousands of dollars in recording equipment amongst thousands and thousands of people that are there to party and have a good time. It's a bad mixture. So we have to walk this fine line where we want to try to do good without, you know, being a jerk or ticking it or being a buzzkill or ticking anybody off. And I would be remiss if I didn't say I didn't get into it with fans here or there. And I have, you know, just if we're flying mics and somebody's right on top of you and having a great time, I'll do my best just to say, hey, can you help me out? You know, can you do me a favor, please? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not here to be a jerk, but it's a gigantic venue. You can go anywhere you want, but you know, do you have to yell right on top of my microphones? Can you just help me out? You know, and I'll do it in the nicest possible way, and mm-hmm. it can come off being really, really negative, unfortunately.
I imagine that that's, apart from the fact that it's sometimes hard to move around and you found your spot and then you have some guy telling you not to socialize with your friends, but I imagine that that's probably fairly, like, no one wants their conversation on a mic and no one wants to ruin a recording.
The moral of the story is really 90%, I would say 9 out of 10 people are totally cool. They say, hey man, I get it. No problem. We'll do it. You know, and then you'll have that one off person that's like, mm-hmm. you know, screw you. Who are you to tell me, you know, not to have a good time. And I'm not saying don't have a good time. I'm just saying, can you help me out this one time? You're right on top of me.
Cool. Well, a little bit earlier, you recommended we listen to the What's the Use from Magna Ball. Why don't you give us a little bit more music? So, RJ, are you going to give us the okay to play a little bit of music to take us out, or do you have any more questions for Lenny?
No, I think that's great. I'd love to send it off with the music.
But before that happens, I really want to thank you so much for coming on Under the Scales, a new podcast. We haven't actually yet released. We're coming out in November 2016, and this is being recorded in August 2016.
Awesome.
So I really appreciate your coming on.
I appreciate you having me, of course. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you again. And why don't you let us know a cool, like something that you've spent a lot of hours listening to?
So yeah, this is my kind of go-to audience recording, and it was done with a dear friend of mine who passed away tragically in February of 2015 on that Metro North train crash. So an old friend of ours, Eric Vanderkar, who was a New York City head and taper, longtime taper and contributor to the whole scene. We first hooked up at the Clifford Ball. We had known each other for a little bit, and I patched out of his recording, and we spent the whole weekend together on the field in the taper section. The overall sound is just so smooth, and you know, the mics were just right, and he dialed it in just exactly perfect, and you know, the crowd noise is right where it needs to be. So we just had it, and we had the spot, and the sound was there, and I circulated them, you know, far and wide over the years, really some of my most favorite recordings that I've been a part of any era, especially the 1.0 era.
We are immensely grateful to Lenny Stubbe for coming on here, and we're going to take you out with some Clifford Ball. Why don't you give us the exact song that we should play?
How about Fluffhead? I mean, one of the best Fluffheads. The you know, what an arrival from Trey on that version.
Perfect. Here it is, Fluffhead from Clifford Ball. We'll be right back. We'll sign off on that note. On behalf of Under the Scales, I'd like to really thank RJB. Thank you, RJ. I'd like to also, of course, thank Lenny Stubbe and Jonathan Hart. Jonathan and RJ, of course, are part of the podcast HF Pod, and that stands for Helping Friendly Podcast. And I'm Tom Marshall, Under the Scales, and thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to Under the Scales, the podcast about fish fans, their culture, and secrets, if we're lucky. Quick thank you to my producer, Mark Dowd, and my sister podcast, HF Pod. Some of the music you hear in my show is, of course, Fish, but also it's often my old band, Amphibian, with an F. Using songs Anthony Cries on and I wrote for our album, Skip the Goodbyes. Find him at njrecordingstudio.com. I'll interview you if you want as well. Go to underthescales.com and click the Tell Your Story button. If you're at all serious, your submission will definitely get to me. For other matters, write to me at tom@underthescales.com and follow our Twitter here at underthescales. See you next week.